Good morning, and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also very pleased in this part of Focus 580 to be talking once again with Martin Marty, probably one of this country's best-known commentators on religion, its history, its role in public life. He is an emeritus professor at University of Chicago. He is the Fairfax M. Cohn Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus at University of Chicago, where he taught mostly in the Divinity School for 35 years. He's also a Lutheran pastor. He was ordained in 1952 and served parishes in the west and northwest suburbs of Chicago for a decade before joining the faculty at University of Chicago in 1963. He has since 1956 been on the staff and been columnist for the Christian Century. He is author of more than 50 books, thousands of articles, and has been involved in many associations and institutions. Just to name a couple, he was president of the American Academy of Religion, the American Society of Church History, and the American Catholic Historical Situation. And that's pretty good if you're a Lutheran. He is going to be here in Champaign-Urbana to take part in a symposium looking at violence and religion. And this is sponsored by the folks in the Program for the Study of Religion and the Illinois Forum on Religion in America. This is all taking place tomorrow on the U of I campus, 9 a.m. to 12:30 in room 407 of the Illini Union. That's on Green Street in Urbana. And I think that it is open to anybody who is interested in attending. I'm sure for more information, you can go to the website of the Program for the Study of Religion and find out more about it. We thought it would be a good subject to take up here on the program to talk a little bit about this very subject, violence, religion in America. And Dr. Marty was good enough to say yes, he would spend some time with us here this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. At any point here, questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief so that we could keep our program moving. But, of course, anyone who is interested in talking with us should feel welcome. Professor Marty, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Glad to talk.
We appreciate it. I have been thinking about this, and I guess I have been thinking about Richard Dawkins, only because he is now, lately, I think, perhaps one of the best-known anti-religionists going. He's a biologist. He's written this book that's done very well in terms of sales, The God Delusion, here over the past couple of months, and is someone who has been known, I think, for a long time for arguing against religion for a number of reasons. And one of his arguments, and he's certainly not the first to make that argument, is that evil, violence, has been done in the name of religion by people who claim to be people of faith, and that it's problematic because it can be a driving force, not for good in the world, but for ill. And that is, I suppose, perhaps a basic thing to be dealt with, and a point that we could start with. I mean, how exactly do you deal with the fact that, and you can't argue that that's not true.
Okay.
How do you deal with that fact?
All right. Let's just purge one little thought along the way, and that is, you have hit on the one thing in his book I agree with. And for the rest, it's taken a pounding by reviewers, and not so much for his atheism, which is, I would say, rather conventional atheism, but for his assumption that if you got rid of religion, the world would be nonviolent and peaceful. And almost every reviewer has said the 300s of millions of deaths in the 20th century under Mussolini, Hitler, Stalin, Mao were done by explicit atheists, Mussolini not quite as much as the others. So I guess what we have to say is religion and non-religion both are productive of violence, and we have to get at the roots of it. And getting rid of religion, obviously from those examples, would suggest you won't get rid of violence. We have to reach further and more.
Mm. That I get. Well, I suppose, yes, my feeling, too, about what he has to say is that I think it... I suppose religion can be problematic, can be a force for ill in the world. I don't think that necessarily argues against the possibility that it can be a force for good. I think that's the throwing out the proverbial baby. You know,
I'm certainly granting him the main point, and I've spent a lot of my recent decades studying the ways in which religion is a prompter of violence. I wouldn't minimize that at all. It's a huge subject, and our little conference tomorrow is on that subject.
Yeah. Well, how do you think about that then? Okay. The fact that indeed it can what he says is true.
Okay. Well, I'll be reminiscent for a second. It's September 14th, 2001. I was giving a lecture for the Mortenson Library at the University of Illinois, and a year earlier, the librarian, Marianka Cholin, and I had agreed on a title, Religion, the Killer That Heals and the Healer That Kills. And, of course, then along came 9/11 3 days before, and I think everybody on campus thought that this was going to be about 9/11. Obviously, we had moved to a bigger hall, and I did address it that way, but that wasn't the original intent. What I would say is that 9/11 was a terrifying, apt illustration of the potential for violence in religion. And what interested me is that if you're up close in these cultures of violence, you'll find that most of them are, I'm not talking about suicide bombers now and Osama bin Laden, but the people that you see in the newsreels, the grieves people that are bombed out in Baghdad and so on, they basically just want to live their lives like anybody else. They have children. They have wish they had food and light and water. They don't want to die. All that goes on. And along the way, they are also, in most cases, Muslim. And they are inspired both for their good and their evil by their Islam, which is also the case when you hear them talk. And I directed a project some years ago which brought together 110 scholars of all the religions discussing hardline religion. And they said, you know, from our distance, both World War I and Japan aside, World War II were Christian wars. And chaplains on both sides and the people back home in the churches were praying that God would kill the enemy and protect our troops. We don't think of it that way because we see it as culture. And it wasn't that the churches started by saying, let's kill other Christians or kill anybody else. But the potential is always there. So I think we have to get at the roots of what it is about religion that it is so powerful that it can do both of these things. Mm.
I think that some people would also come into the argument and say, well, yes, it seems that particularly in the 20th century and this part of this century that we have conflicts, many conflicts that have religious dimensions, and yet at the same time they would argue that, but those conflicts really, they're not about religion. It's not matters of doctrine that people are fighting over. It's who has access to resources, who gets to control them, who's on top in society, that it's really not about religion. In fact, religion might either tell you that it's okay to do it or tell you that it's not. But then I guess I feel like you have to ask the question, well, in what sense does religion enter into it at all? And so to what's in what sense is religion somehow accountable?
Right. Well, I think it works two ways. One, I like to say phenomenally, and the other epiphenomenally, which translated in English means that it can be the phenomenon that starts it all. You can simply hate the other. The religions, in some of these cases, are exclusive and bitterly exclusive. I've got God and you haven't. I've got it figured out and you don't, and I can do what I want. And you offend me, and the circumstances being equal, I'll move you out of my territory or kill you or whatever. And in that case, I'd have to say religion is at the base and a major impeller, and the sacred books of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam can give such people enough impetus that they can have jihad or holy war or killing in the name of a warrior god. Epiphenomenally is the one I think you're referring to, and that is it's attached to it. It's like a barnacle and something else, or it's an impeller. Take one illustration a little bit off the regular scene here. Northern Ireland. Every day that you hear about intense hatreds there, it always is labeled Protestant and Catholic. Well, yes, but I think most of these people who go to church and march against Catholics or Protestants are probably in church that one day of the year. They go in a firebrand. I'm thinking, for example, of the Presbyterian fundamentalist Ian Paisley, stores up a year's worth of hate and spills it on him. And sure, it sounds like their Bible, it sounds like their doctrine. Go out and beat up on the Catholics. and the same goes on with the Catholics. However, the vast majority of Protestant Catholics in Northern Ireland don't live there. 20-some years ago, the Nobel Prize was given to groups of women who were Catholic and Protestant, who met regularly, who prayed together, who worked for peace together, etc. And they are the regular mass goers and church goers. So here, if you already start hating people because several centuries ago somebody planted them there that you didn't like, and then there are economic differences and elite differences and political differences, and then if you could say the God of Protestants or the God of Catholics wants to impel me to blow up your buildings, it's added on. But I think we have to pay attention to both of them. It can be the main impetus, and it can be a side issue.
Well, you talked about the fact that it's in many religious traditions in the Scripture, if people are intent on committing violence, they may be able to find something that will sanction that. Given, though, that in also in these traditions that the desire for the drive for peace is so important, why is it that that doesn't trump anything that you could find to sanction violence?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're exactly right about the final goal. I think you could take certainly Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, which also is driven by these forces, all of those that have some sense of history, all are devoted to saying that the last word of their religion and of human intent is shalom. It's peace. It's reconciliation. The prophets all spill that out. After exile, after suffering, after all the travail you go through, after all your enmities and guilts, your God wants you finally to be in a realm of peace and serenity and positive well-being. You're right, that's there, and I think the great task through the ages is to try to have that show up more. I think an interesting thing about that is it shows up in billions of particular ways that don't make headlines. That is, up and down the block, Islamic charities, Jewish philanthropy is huge, Christian charity, boy, after Katrina, the government floods entirely and the churches are on the scene. They are all living by that impulse, quoted so often in presidential inaugurals on the prophet Micah, do justly, love mercy, walk humbly with your God. And the goal of that then is peace and peacefulness. Unfortunately, human nature being what it is, and I can't define it, I can only point to it, as Mary McCarthy once said, religion makes good people good and makes bad people bad. If you have a reason to define and demonize the other, it sure boosts the cause if you can say God wants that. When Pope Urban called for the Crusades by Christians in the Middle Ages, well, he shouted in Latin, Deus lo vult, God wants it. And you're a knight in Western Europe, you're bored silly, you know how to do tournaments, you know how to stab people, and you got to have somebody to stab. So God wills that you should go now to Jerusalem and win back the holy places from the infidel. And vice versa, there were plenty of Muslims killing Christians and Christians killing Christians because, quote, God wills it. So I think that if you have an evil tendency, and you can justify it by saying God wills it, it's going to be more dedicated. Let's take a suicide bomber who is actually religious. I think an awful lot of suicide bombers are almost derangedly remote from where they started out. But certainly most of them will read a holy book the night before they do it, and they'll have a prayer, so they think they're doing it religiously. In all those cases, this goes so very deep. Their mother's love for the child can't beat it. Your family doesn't beat it. Your desire for well-being, I'd hate to be exploded. And you can give all that up because God wills it. So I think that's the dangerous part of it. And that's why, I remember Abraham Lincoln once said, the better angels of our nature have to be invoked. I do believe that humans can go both ways. And that all the charities I mentioned, and all the saints and heroines and so on, are exemplars, but most of that doesn't make news. I studied religion for a lot of years in these fields, and I don't think anybody paid a lot of attention to a lot of it until the Iranian revolution, 1979, all of a sudden we started scrambling and trying to figure this out. Well, you can go back into our history. I think that slavery was massively defended on biblical grounds. God intended, legitimates it, wants you to own other human beings, do anything you want with them, beat them up. A lot of these clergy wanted humane treatment, but they didn't go against slavery. That's one of the two biggest crimes in our record, and it was always justified religiously. I don't know any Southern preachers in the 1830s, 40s, 50s of note who said anything but that. And I think the removal of the Indians, originally there were some well-meaning people who wanted to either convert them or live with them, but the minute land became valuable, you pushed them out, and while there were Indian missions always, just as there were black missions and black churches, you still justified that this land belongs to us because God gave it to us. On what grounds? It was never made clear.
Mm. Well, that's it's interesting that point, particularly about how religion supported the church and preachers supported the idea of slavery. When we're talking about religion and violence, it suggests that we need to have a relatively expansive definition of what violence is, and that also it suggests that we really should spend as much time as we do condemning other people for their violence and the fact that their religion might sanction it. We better at least spend some time looking at our own history and thinking about the ways in which the same thing happened and had important ways shaped American life and American history, perhaps.
Yeah, I'm not a bit interested in. And though we are often accused of that, equity, you know, Muslims did it, so we have to say Christians did it. Iraq is doing it, so we have to say America does it. I'm not interested in saying there's a balance sheet in which these have to come out even, but I think you're right here that we can't control what somebody else thinks or does, but we can control what we think and do. And I think that's the creative side that goes on when there's self-examination.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Martin Marty. He is an emeritus professor at the University of Chicago, where he taught for 35 years. He has now for many years been writing about and talking about religion in America, its history, its place in American society. He's authored many books, many, many articles. He's going to be here on the campus to take part in a program sponsored by the folks at the Illinois Forum on Religion in America and the Program for the Study of Religion and some others as well. It's a long list. I hope they'll forgive me for not reading them all. I'll be taking part in this conference, Saving Faith, Killing Faith, A Religious History of Violence and Restraint in America. That's what it's being called. He's one of several people who will be here, and this is all taking place tomorrow on the U of I campus, starting at 9 in the morning in room 407 of the Illini Union on Green Street in Urbana. Here for our conversation, questions and comments are welcome, as always. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we do have someone here on a cell phone to join the conversation on line one. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
My observation and asking for your comment is this. Speaking of violence in relation to religion, I believe that it's really at the root cause of this is when man believes that he is, so to speak, innate good, and thereby takes on the role of dispensing justice onto others. What would be your thought on that?
I certainly believe that's at least a half-truth. That is, in effect, if you believe you're basically good, again, you can believe you're basically good, but when you act upon it the way you're describing, in a sense, you're taking over God's role. You're deciding where history should go. You're deciding who should live and who should die. And since you're good, don't worry about the others. And the reason I say it's half is because I believe that a great deal of violence is also born of self-hatred, of very weak people. If you study, for example, the Ku Klux Klan, both after the Civil War in Reconstruction, or in its rebirth up the road from you, I don't know where you are, but over across the line in Muncie, Indiana, for example, the town was run by the Ku Klux Klan at a time when it was anti-Catholic. And if you explored, you'd find that a lot of these leaders were ministers. The Bible was always there. God wanted you to do all this, etc. But the more you study the Ku Klux Klan, you find these were not swaggering, self-assured people. These were failures. These were wimps. These were second-rate judges, and so on. So I think you can sometimes strike out at others because nothing's working in your world, just as well as you might say, I'm God in your world.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Others, if you have thoughts to share, you have questions to answer, to ask, or you have answers,
yeah.
Okay. Definitely if you have answers, call us.
Yeah, we welcome answers.
333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess the one thing just that the caller makes me think about, the fact that I think it doesn't matter what kind of religious tradition a person comes from, if they've come to me and said, I can tell you what God wants, I'm scared. And that must be for anyone, and perhaps the great challenge of trying to understand their faith and what it's supposed to be in their life, provided that they're a person who has faith and has that role, is trying to figure out, okay, well, now what exactly am I supposed to do here?
Yes, I think there is such a thing as confidence in faith. I have a Christian faith, and I have a confidence in it and so on, but nowhere was that promised that with that confidence would come all knowingness, which belonged only to God, and all goodness, and so on. And so whatever moves I make, I have to make in the light of the distance between myself and the divine. Oliver Cromwell, in the Puritan Revolution, once said, using anatomical references that were useful in biblical times, by the bowels of Christ, I beseech you to think that you could possibly be mistaken. And that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to stand in front of the mirror and see our limits. We see the few decades we're here. We see how tiny we are in the universe. We may have all the promises of God and confidence and faith, but nowhere does that say that you can use whatever measure of knowledge you have to know exactly how everybody else should live and where the world is going.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with some other folks here. We have a couple of callers. They are mm-hmm. in Champaign. So the first is line one. Hello.
Hi, David.
Yeah.
Steve Shoemaker.
Hi,
thanks,
Steve.
So much for having Professor Marty when other WIL programs are at low power. My question relates to a local situation. The local Hindu community is wanting to have a temple in North Champaign, and has been facing opposition from neighbors. I wondered if he has comments about that, whether that kind of opposition to minority religions is very common. Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, good. It's hard to know without knowing particular cases, but I'll try to give a double kind of description. I had a former student who has written a dissertation and now a book, and I think it'll be a film, about one street in Flushing, New York, called Bowne, B-O-W-N-E Street, which has next to each other Hindu, Buddhist, mosque, Christian, etc. And people living along together pretty well with each other. It's a neighborhood where all the new immigrants have come. It's crowded already. Nobody's getting to build new big parking lots, and they do just fine. And I think that's been the case a lot of places. I am in Cook County, Illinois. West of us is DuPage County, which until a few years ago we used to say was 102% Republican. It is Catholic. It is mainline Protestant, great big colonial churches up and down the block. It's the headquarters of evangelicalism, which often gets a bad rap on this line. Wheaton College is there, the former National Association of Evangelical headquarters. It's all that. And the press tells me 45 non-Judeo-Christian groups worship there weekly. Zoroastrian headquarters for the nation is there. Nichiren Shoshu is there. Theosophy is there. They're all there, and I can't remember an incident among them. I think your question gets complicated if zoning's at issue. And there you'd have to ask, would they be opposing it if First Baptist or Holy Rosary were coming in to build? Because you often do have just that kind of issue that you know, property values, things get crowded and so on. But if they're nervous about it, that they're going to be Hindu, they're probably going to get more peaceful neighbors than almost any other kind of institution they're going to have.
Hmm. I think, you know, here in the United States, we have always listed in one of our values this belief in religious pluralism, that one ought to be free to practice your faith, and at the same time, one ought to be free to practice no faith. I'm not sure that it's ever been very easy for us actually to put that into practice.
No, and yet, again, I'm not a Pollyanna and a public relations agent for America, but I do have to say that on the world scale, given all that's happened, we've lucked out pretty well, and I think we do that on basically three grounds. One, there was always a lot of space. If you didn't like somebody, you went further west, or if you didn't like downtown, you went further suburbs, and we're running out of that now. Secondly, there was always a new supply of people, and somebody new would come, and your first instinct is, they're strangers, I don't like them. And then you find out that they start a restaurant, and you like their menu better than yours, and they have a festival, and you go, and everybody has a good time, and they prove themselves, and they rescue people from fires, and they do all that. You say, hey, that's not bad. But one other element, and I think that's really important, and it's always tested, is the First Amendment and the constitutional tradition. It's only 16 words long. We'll always fight about it. It's never going to be settled all the way. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. There is some tension between those two clauses, and different courts interpret them different ways, but way down deep, it's there, and it'll always be tested, but it's there. So I think those three together. So I wrote I wrote three volumes about 20th century American religion, and the second volume I called The Noise of Conflict because it's the period of the Red Scare, Ku Klux Klan in the North, labor fights, prohibition, woman suffrage, conflict all the while, and I found almost no dead bodies as a result of religion. Some lynchings, you could say, were that, and they were a terrible crime, but they weren't really so much religion as just plain racial hate. Meanwhile, this morning's paper will show you what's going on in Sri Lanka, in Israel-Palestine, in African nations or whatever, where ethno-religious peoplehood and religion are taking more lives than we did in a whole century. So that sounds like bragging rights. I'd rather say it's an alert signal to be welcoming the stranger, keeping the religious freedoms that you've described vivid. I think, for example, what I've studied a lot is the consequence of changes in immigration law in 1965. Nobody paid attention to it, not many did at least, because it was the year we escalated in Vietnam, it was the civil rights marches, it was the welfare and war on poverty and education bills of the Great Society. All that's going on, and Congress changed the immigration laws just in time for the boat people, the Cambodians, Laotians, Vietnamese, Thai people from Southeast Asia to come. And they were planted by Catholic and Protestant churches working with relief services in little Minnesota towns and Iowa towns and Illinois towns. Now, again, that isn't always easy, and some cases are pretty rough. Postville, Iowa, the change was a little too sudden, and you'll hear about it. But by and large, it's a kind of a quiet thing. There are tensions, yes, but are they explicitly religious? Mary Phelps, I think I have her name right, wrote a book called Rescuing Ophelia. And her husband was transferred to Lincoln, Nebraska, and she moving with him, and everybody told her, you are going to be living in the midst of nowhere. And she wrote a new book called Living in the Midst of Everywhere. Over 60 different language groups are in the schools. Most of these are expressive of the religions where people came from, and I don't know of any lynchings in Lincoln either. So again, keeping those three things going is very important. What we're finding difficult, and I think this administration really was naive about this, was that this is easily exportable. If we say, we got our thing working, and so we'll kill a few of you, and peace will come, and then we'll tell you how to make this work. That is not how it works, alas.
Let me introduce again our guest, and we'll go on to some other calls. We're talking this morning with Martin Marty. He is Fairfax M. Cohn, Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus at University of Chicago, where he taught chiefly in the Divinity School for 35 years. He is a Lutheran pastor, ordained in 1952. He did serve parishes in the west and northwest suburbs of Chicago for a decade before joining the faculty at University of Chicago in 1963. He is columnist for the Christian Century, on whose staff he served since 1956. He has authored more than 50 books and many, many articles, thousands of articles. He is frequently called on to comment on religion in America. He'll be here on the campus of the University of Illinois tomorrow to take part in this conference I mentioned a couple times, sponsored by the Illinois Forum on Religion in America, looking at violence and faith in America. And here on the show, questions are welcome. We have several people who would like to join in the conversation, and we'll go next to a caller in Champaign, and this is line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Eleanor Evans, I think in year 73, maybe, I heard you speak, Martin Marty.
Yes.
And was very impressed. My husband and I belong to a progressive Christianity discussion group called Reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the books we did was Borg's The Heart of Christianity. We did Science and Religion. We're doing that right now. Don't like it in some respects. But we all come from different churches. We meet in a Methodist church. Have you written anything recently on... We're looking for a more progressive Christianity that allows for other faiths and allows you, some of us don't believe in the Trinity. We don't believe that Jesus is the only way to God. We even feel sometimes that you can limit God by designating him as such and such a figure. Have you written anything recently about this?
Well,
that we could discuss.
I have. You ask an author something like that, and that's just like setting up a ball for T-ball for kindergartners.
Oh.
There's always something. I can't run you through the yellow pages and describe a church body or something like that. Wouldn't if I could. But exactly addressing what you're talking about, I did a book a year or two ago called When Faiths Collide.
Okay.
Published in England and the U.S., and it's in paperback from Blackwell. And what it sets out to do is it shows, and what your discussion group is a good illustration of it, it shows that the way to bring peace is to meet the other face-to-face, look them in the eye, learn where they come from, find what they're about. It's disarming. Now, my interest in that book was very often people think that if you do that, you have to have no commitment or low commitment.
Mm-hmm.
I even have a little section in it expressing a little bit of nervousness about one of my favorite categories called tolerance, because tolerance was hard fought for mm-hmm. for centuries, and it's a wonderful thing. But if you listen carefully, a lot of people say today tolerate, they really mean, if I can get you to believe as little as I do, we'll both get along well.
Oh.
And my interest is to show how growth comes by meeting the other who has convictions. I have a young friend in Chicago. He's an Indian background Muslim, Ibu Patel.
Mm-hmm.
You might even look him up on Google. I get no commission for reporting it, but he started something called the Interfaith Youth Core, C-O-R-E. So remember those words. I'm sure you'll find him, and he'll answer. What he did was, first of all, he noticed that most people who have these interests have gray hair, and he said, they're likely to live long enough without us all killing each other. But what about young people who don't show up? And so he organized this for people under 30. They go to high schools. They go to all kinds of places, and they have the favor and support of the religious groups because you can't get in unless you... are motivated by religion and a specific religion.
Uh-huh.
I don't mean these exclusive barriers. I'm just saying that's the ethos. So I think I would do that. And you might look around that book. One of the categories I develop in there, and then I promise to get off my own writing, but you asked me. Instead of tolerance, I like the word hospitality, mm-hmm. which can sound a little soft and mushy, but it doesn't really. We all know what xenophobia is. It means fear and hatred of the stranger. Xenophilia is regard for the stranger, and that is the Greek word translated into English as hospitality.
I see.
So you always start with strangers. So I use an illustration. If you're invited to the Marty House, and it's Friday night, and you're a Jew, we aren't going to take the pictures or the cross of Jesus sculpture off our wall. Mm-hmm. But we will listen differently, we'll talk differently, and so will you. Mm-hmm. And if it's Friday night and you're Jews and you say, well, the Martys are coming and they're Christians, and so tonight we aren't going to light the candle and pour the wine and break the bread and say the prayer. No, we'll be cheated. We want to know who you really are. Mm-hmm. But we will talk differently, and so will you. Mm-hmm. And I think that little image of house to house can be enlarged in groups like the one you describe. And a lot of us have an interest in seeing where that can't be worked out civilly, that is, in the public square.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What was Eboo's last name?
Pardon?
What was Eboo's last name?
Oh, Patel. Eboo is E-B-O-O. His last name is Patel, P-A-T-E-L.
Okay.
After 43 years in the same town, our high school was moved up to everyone's surprise, in the top 100 ranks in America, and somebody said, you know, you had 4 children and 2 foster children going to that high school. Would you come and make a presentation? And I said, there's nothing deader for a high school freshman than to see a 78-year-old scholar come out for 45 minutes. So I had the brilliant idea, I think it's brilliant, of saying, come on, Eboo. And he and I did a program, and it was just fun for me to watch the faces of kids, to see their generations represented with realism and hope.
That's great. Okay, well, thank you.
Okay. I appreciate the comments of the caller. I also want to mention that, by the way, since you mentioned Eboo Patel, that he's going to be here in Champaign-Urbana next week, and he's going to be on this show, Focus 580. I hope we have this right. People will better check the schedule as we get closer to it, but I believe he's scheduled to be with us on the 9th. In the 10 o'clock hour, and then he's also going to be speaking on down on the campus at noon. So when we get closer to that, I'm sure that we'll have that information.
I didn't know I was being an advance agent, but I will assure you that both the radio program and the event will be lively. I can't get over. We did a program at the Museum of Contemporary Arts. Again, a lot of young people there. I can't get over the suppleness with which he can get inside of how Christians think, how Jews think, how Muslims think. Very sparkling kind of thing. So he owes me one. Okay.
Right. We'll tell him that when he's see him. I say, you owe Marty something. Take him, buy him coffee, take him to dinner. Let's talk next with somebody on here on our line 4. I think it's Kink Key, line 4. Hello.
Let us consider the case of the Christmas truce of 1914. Part of the reason the soldiers left to the trenches to celebrate together in no man's land is because they all knew the same songs. To avoid interfaith violence, would people not do well to learn the songs of other people's faiths? Your comments, please.
Good.
Thank you.
Well, you're throwing it into a new dimension as one I care a great deal about, namely the arts. Yes, it would help. I like to quote the philosopher George Santayana, who said, the religions have some things in common, and they should work to find them. But he said the motivating power, the emotional power, the saving power of religions come from what he calls the surprising and idiosyncratic stories they tell. And I think that'd be true of our songs, too. And yet they can travel. I'll give an illustration. Amazing Grace was written by a former slave captain who got converted. And it sort of languished in the shadows. It was sung in evangelical and black churches for a while. All of a sudden, it gets to be number one, and Scottish bagpipers are playing it, and it's all over the place. Now, it doesn't explicitly use the name of God, and so the Christian's going to read Amazing Grace comes this way. I go to big events in Chicago public parks, 30,000 people there, and somebody does Amazing Grace, and you'll hear all kinds of people singing them. Music can do it, and I think music also can help us get inside how somebody else thinks. I admit it's a little hard to do in high school forums. I'm one who thinks that you can have these songs you're describing in high schools as long as it's clear that they're performance and not worship. We get a lot of junky stuff in December, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, when you have the great, great music of Christmas and Hanukkah and so on, which I'd like to have them learn. But I think beyond that, all kinds of places. I was accidentally, I'd say, on stage at the Gospel Festival in Chicago a year ago, summer in the park. 30,000 people out there singing We've Got the Power and so on. And I don't think any Muslim or Jew walking by was offended by that. It was an exuberance to it. We have a little more to learn with some others. If we're Christian, we're made nervous by other forms of worship, but we shouldn't be. Finally, on arts, I would just say, an illustration of this. Some years ago, four of us scholars were meeting in Salzburg in the palace where they filmed The Sound of Music, and we invited in 54 people, one each from every group that can't stand the others. Seven former Yugoslavias, three Southern Africas, two Northern Irelands. And we just see how far you can get in 2 weeks of open discussion, and a lot happens. The second year, the first afternoon, we're in that big room, and nobody knows anybody. somebody said, Mrs. Marty played last year. And my wife said, well, I didn't bring any music. We'll play something. So she played some Mozart because it's his town. And some of the people from Tajikistan said, we never heard that music. Do The Sound of Music. My wife said, people in Salzburg don't like The Sound of Music. They're tired of that. But she said, all of a sudden, the whole room is singing Do a Deer, Female Deer, and my favorite things. American popular musicals reached everybody. All the while, one man in black stood off by himself. And he walked over, ceremoniously bowed, kissed her hand, turned to the group and said, I am from the Ayatollah Khomeini's government. I am here to represent it. We are never allowed to be where there's music that we're not making. We're never allowed to be where it's secular music. We're certainly never allowed to be where women are making music. And you can be sure I would have gone through life never kissing the hand of a woman in bare-arm summer dress. But then he turned to them and quoted some Sufi sayings involving Allah, saying the encouragement of beauty and the growth of community, I can't come up with the exact text, is so important. I'm going to spend these 2 weeks just observing that. And the last night at the banquet, he toasted for the whole 54 with a glass of water, because he's Muslim, and he said, thanks to that music that opened this all up, I could hear differently that week, etc. And across the table from me is Gary from Tel Aviv, the only Jew I've ever met, and he's my best friend among the 54 of you. Now, we don't have those miracles all the time, but I like to tell that story because it does illustrate that art can often break down what propositions can't work through.
Yeah, that's a great story. Well, let's see if we can talk with some more folks in the time that remains. We have some local callers.
Someone I found a shorter answer.
No, well, it's a good story. Sometimes you just can't cut good stories short. Here we have someone on line one here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. Line one, hello.
Hi, comment on the so-called faith-based programs, and in particular the news report that said one Department of Corrections will have separate buildings for inmates who attend preaching and who admit that their misbehavior is due to sin.
Yes, I'll be glad to comment. Faith-based is a very complex issue. It has some positive sides and easy to administer, namely when a group sets up a legally free entity. The Salvation Army does this. Lutheran Immigration Relief Services, Catholic Relief Services, make it very clear, they really administer, I know Lutheran services best, we Lutherans support it, but every penny of resettlement was government funds and no complaints. Why? Because there's no proselytizing, no effort to convert, no, and so on. You're simply serving. You're motivated by your faith, but that ends there. It gets complex. One of the studies we made was of a program in Mississippi, an African-American Baptist pastor who clearly had the best program for keeping kids off drugs, but he said, I can't do it without dunking them underwater and having them come to Jesus, etc., on tax funds. Well, that's over the line. If I'm a Jew, if I'm anything, I'm pretty nervous about my tax funds going to get people to join a particular other group. So you can overdo it. So the one you're pointing to is really a tricky one. Charles Colson's prison ministry has had courts rule against it in Iowa, where they had it going. And just last week I read of a case, Arizona or somewhere, that was really disturbing, and I doubt if it's going to stand up legally, where judges coercively send, it doesn't bother you nearly as much if somebody in prison says, yeah, I'd go 11 at night and sing hymns and get motivated. But when the judge says, I'm sentencing you to that facility where a particular religious group was doing it all, I don't think it'll stand up in court along the way, but I think you're really getting into a zone where it shows how hard it is to have absolute lines.
All right. Well, again, time is short here. We're trying to get at least one more caller, okay. And this would be the next in line is in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would be interested in Dr. Marty's reactions, comments. Whether I agree that we should be in Iraq as we are or not is not my point. I'm concerned about the anti-American feeling that seems to be really growing around the world, not just anti-government, American anti-government, but toward just everyday Americans who are not being allowed to participate in just some humanitarian projects around the world. Do you have any comment about how we can deal with the anti-Americanism?
You're pointing to a very sad theme. I still think most places in the world that you go, the American is well greeted and well liked. And I'm particularly interested in sub-Saharan Africa, where just tens of thousands of Christian groups from Africa and elsewhere are there, and Americans are there and appreciated. The removal of the disease of river blindness, now soon the disease of tapeworm and so on. These are really appreciated things. They get mixed up on a couple of levels. One, and we can't go into the politics of the Iraq War, as you said, that's too complex, but it's very clear that that has given firebrands reasons to stop liking us. What can we do? I think we have to tell the two stories. I think we have to keep doing what we're doing. I think we have to let the other nations determine a little more of how this will all go on. I'm down about how the last 10 years or so has soured. I think right after 9/11, the whole world was on our side, and we let that slip. But it's nearly quitting time, so we can't get into the politics of it. Just keep doing the good things and getting the story out and showing other sides. I think one other thing we quickly have to say is another thing about America I think that offends them is the pop culture that gets transported most vividly, and that offends a lot of Americans.
Right.
It certainly offends people if you're in a culture where near nakedness is not in public display, and when they hear the reports of our celebrity life. So we have some house cleaning to do along the way, but I don't despair.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. One more caller here. This is line 2. This is also someone in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, Dr. Marty. I think you have a different history of the hymn Amazing Grace than I have. Mm-hmm. It's true it was written by a slave ship captain, mm-hmm. but it was written for dumping bodies overboard and for the crew to sing as they were being put in the ocean. It's also, in the Old South, no self-respecting black lynch mob would ever hang a black person without singing Amazing Grace. And that's as a folklorist, this is the knowledge I have on that song. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, you may know more than I do about it. My pitch was I used to always go around saying how horrible it was that song was written by a slave ship owner, and I would always get corrected and say that he stopped and changed and all that. So I don't know the subsequent history, so I will have to do some Googling and looking up, and I will learn, and I'm in the world to learn, so I thank you if that's the case.
We are at the point that we have to finish. You know, just I'm thinking about the fact that just this last week I had the opportunity to talk with Joel Hunter, who is an evangelical minister. He's Methodist, and last summer was picked to head the conservative Christian group, the Christian Coalition, and then interestingly enough, last fall, stepped down before really taking office officially because he had a disagreement with the board of the coalition as to the focus of the organization. He seemed to be interested in moving beyond some of the big hot-button issues to some things like environmentalism, for example, or dealing with poverty. And we talked about the possibility of people of different viewpoints finding some middle ground to work on. And he said something really interesting. He said, well, you know, I'm not interested in breeding moderates. He said, I'm really interested in people who are passionate about what it is they believe in.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that it seems to me, though, if you got people like that, it's still a big challenge to actually have a conversation and find whether there are, in fact, things that you can agree on.
Yes. Well, I am cheered that the Christian Coalition has further to go, but National Association of Evangelicals and evangelicals in general, who used to think that environmental issues were harmonic convergence and New Age and Hindu and all that, and are coming around to see that it's page one of their own Bibles to have steward of the earth. And some of them are still very self-protective, but others are working in open coalition. And as that energy gets turned force in America, that's going to be good along the way. And I don't know whether Hunter's definition is exactly that. I deal with a lot of people who would be called agnostic who have passion and bring wonderful contributions to our culture. So I'm not sure that the passion has to be directed to a specific religion, but I think he's right that if you can't get passionate about something, you can't get passionate about serving other people either. That's what I was saying before. I think aggressive, assertive, open-faced hospitality in which you look in the face of the stranger and see what you can have in common works better than weak tolerance.
There we must end. Our guest is Martin Marty. He's an emeritus professor at University of Chicago. If you're interested in reading his writing, he has written many books. You go to the library and the bookstore and look for them. Also, he will be here in Champaign-Urbana to take part in a program sponsored by the Program for the Study of Religion, Saving Faith, Killing Faith, A Religious History of Violence and Restraint in America, tomorrow, 9 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. in room 407 of the Illini Union on Green Street in Urbana. Anyone, I believe, is welcome to attend if they'd like to participate. You can also get more information by going to the website of the Program for the Study of Religion at U of I. Either you can just go right there, or we have a link on our website, so you can go that way. In either case, you can find out more about it. And Dr. Marty, thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Enjoy the time.